give us a little time to put up a map here. You can turn to Genesis chapter 10 while you're waiting. Long since I used that map, it wouldn't even unfold for me this morning. So it's, maybe we can put a piece of tape down at the bottom. All right. Thank you very much, Brother Josh. Let's sing one verse of God of Grace and God of Glory. On thy people pour thy power, crown thine ancient church's story, bring its bud to glory's flower, grant us courage, grant us wisdom for the facing of this hour. And that's the way the second part of that goes. God of grace and God of glory, on thy people pour thy power. Crown thine ancient church's story, bring her bud to glorious flower. Grant us courage, grant that's wisdom for the facing of this hour. For the facing of this hour. I wish I had brought the words to the rest of those verses. It talks about the evil hosts surrounding and all the challenges we face. And I think it's very apt to this particular chapter. Now, I have had more apprehensions about this sermon than any sermon I have ever preached, and maybe you won't even think it's a sermon. It's going to be more a geography lesson, a description of God and the nations and what became of them. They had certain plans, but those plans didn't get carried out, as we would find out in chapter 11. God scattered them. If they'd have had their way about it, they would all have stayed right here in this region. Now, they came out of the ark up here at Ararat, but a group of them, and I'm convinced not all of them did. I think Shem and a godly seed stayed probably in this area, but a group of them, and we're going to find out how it happened, and that's why this chapter is very important, because it lays the foundation and the groundwork for what we see in the next chapter, in fact, indeed, in the rest of the Bible and to the end of history. Something happened here in this chapter that affected the whole world. But anyway, a group of them had migrated down here, and they decided they were going to build a great civilization there, and they were going to stay there. And God had other plans, and this chapter that we're looking at this morning shows you what happened. This chapter actually comes after the first part of chapter 11, because it talks about these various nations as they went to various places with their various tongues. You'll notice it says that every time. When it talks about these nations, it talks about their tongues. So obviously, what happened in chapter 10 took place after the confusion of tongues, and this was the result. And so one thing we learned from this chapter, I was concerned there maybe wouldn't be as many spiritual lessons from this particular sermon as what I always like to have, even from an Old Testament passage. But what we learn in this chapter is that God totally rearranged the plans that men had made. They had planned it otherwise. What you see in this chapter was not what they had in mind. This was God's doing. And we definitely are talking about God and the nations when we're looking at this passage. And I'm not going to read it. This is indeed, well, my only apology for preaching this message is that this is in the Bible, and I'm working through Genesis, and we have to do something with this chapter. I probably spent more time on this chapter than I ever did on any sermon, and I feel probably poorer prepared to preach it because it has so many details and I can't keep them all in my mind. So you're going to have to forgive me if this doesn't come together quite as well as what I'd like for it to come together. But I hope by the time we're finished with this passage, you get a little bit of an idea of where these people in the world came from. I told you there are not races of people. The idea of racism is foreign to the whole concept of Scripture. This is just talking about nations of people. And sometimes they intermingled. And the concept that there's a certain race and then over here's another race, that's not in this chapter. That's just not the mentality at all. We're talking about groups, people groups, and where they went. All right, now, there are about 70 different names in this passage. 70 different people groups listed here. And so that will give you a little bit of an idea why I struggled to get this together in my own mind. And I'm not sure I still have it all. Now, I'm going to make some connections as I go through the passage of where these people went and some names that we still have with us, names in historical records that we can connect to these groups. We can't connect them all, but we can make an awful lot of connections. But I just want to warn you to begin with, you're going to say, well, he said this name connects with this name, but then it doesn't sound the same. Well, this is a little bit how names are. In Virginia, we have a group of people called Heatwool. Well, the original spelling of that name was the German. Now, I don't know if you saw those two names, if you'd put them together or not. And then we have some people in this country called Zimmerman. And that same family has a group of people that's related to it. This is the German word for woodworker. Well, some people came to this country and decided, well, that won't mean anything in English, so we'll just translate it. So they called themselves carpenters. And so now if I'd say, now, carpenter came from Zimmerman, you'd say, wait a minute, I'm not that stupid. They don't sound alike. So what I'm trying to say to you is, before we get into this, I want you to understand that when I say this name is related to this name, and it doesn't sound very much the same, some of them will, some of them won't, just remember that we have transliterations. That's what we call this. This stuff is called transliterations. You can either give an English spelling for what the original sounded like, or you can just completely translate the name, and then the next time you can do something different. And so as these names go down through, they change in their form, they change in their sounds, and some of them got handed down many, many times through many different situations. So I just want to say that before I start, before you say, well, he surely was stretching that one, because I don't see any connection between those names. So if I tell you there's a connection, you just assume that you can take it in good faith that I found in my research a reason for telling you that. All right. So, wait, I didn't. This is really bad here. I thought when I wrote that there was something wrong. Okay. This is indeed one of the most remarkable chapters in the Bible. That might not look that way to you. And like I said, I'm not going to attempt to read it because it would bore you to tears. We're going to look at pieces of it as we go down through. There is no comparable catalog of the ancient nations anywhere from any other source. This is unique. And secular historians go back to this passage. People who don't even believe in the inspiration of the Bible go back to this passage to make some sense out of the people groups that exist in our world today. This is a unique piece of literature. Well, we believe it's more than literature, obviously. Dr. William F. Albright, the world's leading authority on the archaeology of the Near East, recognized to be so, who does not believe in the infallibility of the Scriptures, had this to say about this passage. This passage stands alone in ancient literature without a remote parallel, even among the Greeks, where we find the closest approach to distribution of peoples in genealogical framework. The table of nations in Genesis chapter 10 remains an astonishingly accurate document and a unique one. There are 70 nations listed here. And we're going to find that word that at the end of my message, I'm going to show you places where the Israelite people took this very seriously, that there were 70 nations. And the number 70 becomes very important to the children of Israel. And they actually connect it with this particular passage. We'll look at that at the end of the message. We have 26 nations that came out of Shem. We have 30 nations that come out of Ham. And we have 14 nations that come out of Japheth. And this is the only link in all of literature, in all of historical documents. It's the only link between prehistoric happenings and ancient recorded history. Now, it appears to be a family record that was kept by some of those people. I imagine it was probably kept by Shem, who lived 500 and some years after the flood, lived through the dispersion and saw the outcome of some of that. And so I assume that he maybe kept the first record. All right. We notice a couple things. We find that the descendants of Japheth, we find only to the second generation. The descendants of Ham, in one instance, we find to the third generation, but we find the descendants of Shem continue to the fifth generation. And so that tells us something about the significance of these family groups. Obviously, the person recording it was recording it in terms of its importance to the gospel story, or to the story of God's people. And Shem, of course, stands out. And we'll find in chapter 11, we have a detailed genealogy of the descendants of Shem. We have a partial one in chapter 10. All right. Well, it begins with the oldest. And I hope this does not bore you. I worried two things, that this would bore you. Or three things. Number two, that I wouldn't get it together. And number three, that you would say, well, that was a very unspiritual sermon. Anyway. But it's here. We're going to try to do something with it. Did anybody ever hear a sermon preached on this passage, by the way? I suspect it's one of the more obscure passages. That unless somebody's going through the book of Genesis, it never gets touched. And surely, this is a good reason why you shouldn't preach topical sermons. These passages get missed, and many more like them if you preach topical. Can you imagine a topic on this one? All right. We begin with the family of Japheth. And you'll notice it tells us in verse 2 that he had a list of sons: Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. All right. Well, you're going to notice, I'm just going to tell you just generally speaking, that these people, and remember at the end of chapter 9, it talks about the children of Japheth, that their God shall enlarge them. And we talked about the fact that eventually Japheth was included in the promise. That's not said about Ham. And it's interesting who these people are, and they are called Gentiles. Properly, here are the Gentiles, if you want to know who they are. It says in verse 5, after it lists Japheth's descendants, it says, these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue. There, I told you we're going to see that. That tells us it happened. This is post-Babel. All right? But it says that these are the isles of the Gentiles. Wherever these people went, they are properly known as the Gentiles. Now, Ham's descendants get included in that too when we talk about taking the gospel to the Gentiles. And there was never really any distinction made. But properly speaking, back in the time when this was written, the Gentiles proper were the people of Japheth. Now, where did they go? Well, Japheth, the Greeks have a legendary father. They call him Iapetos, which is a transliteration of Japheth. And so it's just commonly understood, even by the Greeks themselves, that they descended from this person. And then the Aryans in India have a similar name, Iapeta, and he is among them reputed as the ancestor of the Aryans, or the Indian people. So, and then there was a language that tied these two groups together. We don't normally think of India and Europe being tied together, but there was a language called the Indo-European language. And there are similarities, and the European languages and the Indian languages came out of that Indo-European language. And so we have India and we have Europe in this family. Let's just talk about who they were. The first one you see listed there is Gomer. Now, if you look here on the map, you find out where he is up here. Gomer. Gimerai. All right. Well, if you go up here, you have the Cimmerai or the Crimea, which is southern Russia. And so it's thought that these people that inhabited this area and this area were the descendants of Gomer. All right. Now, one branch of them moved west. Most of them stayed around here. A group of them moved west. And I don't know if you can hear Germany in Gimera or not. But that is where the word Germany supposedly originated. Out of this term Gimerai, or Gomer, the descendants of Gomer. If you ever wondered where that term Germany appeared, that it's a transliteration of Gomer, Gemeri, and then Germany. And also the word Cambria is a transliteration of this same word, which would be Wales in England. So we see that a group of these descendants of Gomer or the Gemeri moved west into Germany and on up, some of them, into the British Isles. All right? Well, the next person we have listed, or the next one we're going to look at, he had two sons. If you notice down there, he had two sons. One of them was Ashkenaz, and the German Jews are often called Ashkenazi Jews. And so, again, we're referring to some people who settled up in the area of Germany. All right? The word Scandia is also a transliteration. So we have the Scandinavian people coming out of this tribe of Gomer. And then we have another person listed here. His name is Riphath. That literally transliterates into Europe. So what I'm telling you is these descendants of Japheth basically are the people who finally spread up into Europe, and the nations of Europe basically came out of that. And then we're going to look here at another one. Another person listed here is Togarmah. Well, that is transliterated finally into Turkey and Armenia, which is over in this area. Armenia is right here in the area where Ararat was. And so all of this area also are the descendants of these people. An interesting one is the word Magog, from which the word in Russian, we call it Georgia. I suspect they give that a guttural sound. So you talk about Gorgia, and however that, if you heard the Russians pronounce it, perhaps it would sound more like Gog or Magog. But those are the Russian people. Meshech literally translates into Muscovy or Moscow. And Tubal translates into Tobolsk, which is an actual Russian city. So Magog, Meshech, and Tubal, those names that you see there, those are the progenitors of the Russian people. And then we have Javan, who the Ionians, which were the original Greeks over here in Greece, they called themselves the Ionians, and they claimed this person actually as the founder of Greece, Javan. And then you notice that Javan had a number of sons. Elishia. Well, if you read the Iliad, which I didn't, I read about the Iliad, it talks about the Elysians. This is a transliteration of Elisha. So the Elysians were the Greeks. They come from this same family, as we noticed earlier that they did. Tarshish, we believe perhaps is somewhere, there's a place in Spain called Tartessos, and that's where they went. Kittim is sort of interesting. The word originally meant the people of Cyprus, which I assume that was pronounced Kypros. So we have the Kittim settling in Cyprus, and then we have them moving up into Macedonia, which in their literature is sometimes called Makittim. And then we have Tiras. Tiras is the name that got transliterated finally into Thrace, which goes about from here where Mount Ararat is, the whole way up to the Danube River. That whole area was called Thrace in ancient history. Well, those were the descendants of Tiras. All right. So that is basically the dispersion of Japheth, the Indo-Europeans, the people in Europe, the people in India, and you can just draw a line right down to India. That's basically where those people settled. That's the people group that we're talking about, the descendants of Japheth. Now, interestingly, Ham is given a little bit more extensive treatment than Japheth. So let's look at Ham. You'll notice he had four sons, Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan. And of course, you immediately recognize that Noah placed a curse on Canaan, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Well, Cush basically represents the people of Ethiopia. In their literature, they're called the Kashi. which of course is a transliteration of Cush. So now we're talking about Egypt. First of all, I want you to keep this in your mind. As you read through the Bible, you'll run into these names again. Some of these names appear in the Old Testament history. So now we have the Indo-Europeans. Now we're going to Africa. We have the descendants of Ham. This isn't the only place they settled, but this is one of the places they settled. So we have Ethiopia. We have Mizraim. Egyptian literature uses this name. So these are the people of Egypt, another African country. Some say that Egypt's first dynasty, Menes, is a transliteration of Mizraim. Phut is Libya. Those are the people of Libya. And then we have Cush's sons. We have the next generation here now. Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabtekna. All right? These apparently are all located in the Arabian Peninsula. These were originally Hamites. Now, Semitic tribes, remember, we trace them to Abraham and Ishmael. So later on, these areas were pretty well taken over by Semites, by descendants of Shem. But originally, they were settled by Cush's sons. Well, now, we come to the one that we want to talk about. We don't know too much about any of those, except they basically are Arabian names. But we want to come to the one in verse 8. And Cush begat Nimrod. Apparently, it was his youngest. He's not in that other list. He was born later. And the Bible has something to say about him. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. Okay? It says that he began to be a mighty person in the earth. And it says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, I want to read that out of Jewish literature. The Targum has this way. Nimrod began to be a mighty man in sin, a murderer of innocent men, and a rebel before the Lord. That's how the Jewish Targum translates that particular passage. All right. Cush, Ham's oldest son, it seems here, nourished a resentment against God, against Noah, against God's people for the curse that was placed on Canaan, his uncle. And so he named his son. Now, why would you name your son "Let Us Rebel" unless you felt that in your own heart? So that's why I'm saying there was something happening in Cush's heart that was wrong. And apparently, Cush nourished this rebellion in his own heart. This little fellow was born, and he dreamed of training this boy, I'm just imagining here a little bit, to lead an organized rebellion against God. We're not going to live under this curse. We're not going to serve Japheth and Shem. We're going to rebel. We're going to rule them, in fact. And we're going to make it happen. If it takes plunder, if it takes murder, if it takes robbery, you name it, we're going to conquer these people. We're going to rule the earth. Now, I said this is an important chapter because that is still the spirit of the nations. Some of them are a little more civilized than others. And the United States has been a little bit gentler. I'm not sure. It depends on who you ask. That's why they think the United States has done any better than this. But the nations, the spirit of the nations is to rule as much dominion as they possibly can. And it began in the heart, it seems, of Cush and found its fruition in the heart of this man, Nimrod. All right? He soon had, I think, all of the Hamites and likely many of the Japhethites and many of the Semites under his leadership. And it tells us here that he began to build a great complex of cities. Look here what he did. It says, and the beginning of his kingdom. By the way, that's the first appearance of the word kingdom in the Bible. And it's the devil, not God. All right? And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So you know that this is over into the next chapter. Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calma in the land of Shinar. And out of that land went forth Asher, the progenitor of the Assyrians, and builded Nineveh. So not only
Not only did this man establish this wicked city of Babylon, which at the end of the Bible is symbolic of all of the world's demonic kingdoms, he also established the other wicked city that Israel had to deal with, which was Nineveh. I mean, this man was bad news. And the Bible says that the whole world lies in wickedness. And Jesus told the devil one time, he said, the kingdoms have been given unto me, and I can give them to whoever I want to. And of course, he wanted to give them to Christ if Christ would bow down and worship. And Christ never disputed that. Christ never disputed that the kingdoms of this world were the devil's to dispense with. Of course, we all know that God overrules it all so that it all serves his purpose in the end anyway. But the devil has... there's something about the devil and the kingdoms that we find the whole way through the Bible. This is where it begins. It's right here in the book of Genesis with this evil father, Cush, and his even more evil son, Nimrod. Hunter in Scripture means hunting men by persecution, oppression, and tyranny, this particular word. And we could read this, he became a mighty tyrant in the face of Jehovah. Now, if there's a reason why Christians should not get involved in any of this, I think we can start right here in the book of Genesis chapter 10. And that's what you're getting involved with if you get involved in politics. And in any way, think you're going to do anything with politics, you're going to be disappointed in the end. All right? Perhaps he was a great hunter, originally, of wild animals. I don't know. But he carried it over, finally, into using his power and his prowess to subdue men. And he was evidently... now, this is all a preface to chapter 11. He evidently was the guy that said, let's build this tower and this city. This was probably the man who headed it up. We only know about a couple of these cities. Erech, those of you who have studied ancient history know that that was the home of Gilgamesh, the flood story guy in the literature of Babylon. He lived in Erech. All right? And then it says they went forth into Asher. I'm sorry, I didn't translate that. That really should read they went forth into Asher, not that Asher went forth. In other words, this bunch went forth to build the city of Assyria, or the found the Assyrian nation. All right. So we have the children of Ham. A bunch of them go to Egypt, but this one goes up here to the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley and establishes what become the kingdoms of this world with all the spirit and viciousness that that represents. We have that happening right here. So we have the Hamites here, we have them here. All right? What do we find out about Mithro's sons? We're still in Egypt. Pethrusim, of course, you can identify that with Pathros, which is is Upper Egypt. Casluhim is known as the ancestor of the Philistines. Kaphtorim is Crete. Apparently, a number of these people migrated to Crete. Two of these brothers apparently stayed together and migrated to the island of Crete. And they became the people that eventually migrated back here and established Gaza, which was the civilization of the Philistines. So we have the Philistines coming out of it. We have some pretty formidable people that the Bible doesn't have too much good to say about coming out of this family. All right? Well, we have Canaan listed. Canaan is one of Ham's sons. He's the one that had the curse placed on him. And he had 11 sons. What I noticed in here was this wicked family was very prolific. And I don't know why this is, but it just seems like wickedness took over before the flood in an astonishing rapidity and just covered the whole earth. And here we have it happening again. I mean, we get to this point about God dividing these people up, and we don't realize that the same thing was happening that happened before the flood. I mean, this was a serious malignancy that had to be stopped. We're not just talking about pride. We're talking about violence. We're talking about tyranny. We're talking about nations, a group of people saying we're going to dominate the world. That didn't start with Hitler, and it didn't start with Mussolini, and it didn't start with anybody else. It started right here with this guy. All right, we have Canaan. We'll talk about a couple of his sons. Sidon, which is the Phoenicians. We all know of Tyre and Sidon. Sidon was the more ancient of the two cities. We have Heth.
You remember that, Isaac's Rebekah talked about she was wearing the children of Heth. Well, their descendants were the Hittites. And they were an amazing empire. They established themselves here in Asia Minor and ruled that area for 800 years. All right? Well, after 800 years, their empire here crumbled. This empire crumbled, and it was taken over, and they had to flee. Well, it seems that they fled eastward. Way over here to the far east. Because in the cuneiform monuments, these people are referred to as the Kittai, or the Kittai, which sounds close enough to Cathay. And those of you who have studied ancient history know that Cathay was China. And the archaeologists have noted certain similarities between China and the Hittites. They were tremendous metallurgists. They could cast metal. They could make metal weapons. These people were pioneers in that. And we go over here and find that very shortly after that, these people were doing the same thing. These people were tremendous in the breeding and training of horses. We go over here and we find out these people were too. And so there, not only is there a tie between the names, but we also have a tie between the kind of things they were involved in. And the interesting thing is we have all these people listed here. Look here. Let's see, where were we here? Yes, the descendants of Canaan. Now, of course, a lot of them stayed right there. They were the Canaanites that the children of Israel had to deal with. But there is one interesting one. Look down there in verse 17. One of his sons' names was Sinite. Now, it seems that through ancestor worship and whatever all else, this fellow, whoever he was, got elevated into deity. Because the Assyrian god's name was Sin. And we know about the wilderness of Sin. And we know about Sinai. And we also know that the Chinese people, and a lot of things related to the Chinese, have this prefix, Sino-Japanese War. Whoop. And so apparently a group of these people, these Canaanites, migrated also over to China. All right, so the children of Heth and the children of Sinite apparently are the ancestors of the Chinese. Now, we have an interesting verse here. Would you look here in verse 18 after it lists all these children of Canaan, and it's the longest list. I mean, this guy really did populate the earth with a bunch of bad stuff. Anyway, it says in verse 18, after it lists all those people, it says, and afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. The implication is that they spread faster and further than any other group. In other words, this very, very wicked group of people basically took over most of the world. Because it's thought, as you know, that these people who migrated over here, these Sinites that migrated over here to China, went across the land bridge, they think, into North America, South America. So you have most of the world actually populated by this group, these Hamites. Does that explain to you why there is such a history and such a psychological obsession with nationalism? These are the people that Nimrod came out of. These are the people that God said would be under a curse, and they rebelled and tried to throw off the curse and dominate the world. And they've been trying to do it ever since. They've been trying to dominate the world. All right? So we have widespread godlessness with the spread of these people. Well, let's talk a little bit about Shem's sons. We have them to the fifth generation. Now, he apparently gives more attention to this because he knew that these were the people, it was prophesied by Noah, these were the people that would hand down the true knowledge of God. It says, "The Lord God, blessed be the Lord God of Shem," back in Noah's prophecy. And I already told you that it's inconceivable to me
that Shem, himself at least, and what he represented, that they were involved in what went on down here in the next chapter. We're not told that the whole world was down, that everybody was down here. I think a few of them were still up here. He likely did not migrate to Babel. He perhaps remained near Noah till Noah's death, which would have been long after the Tower of Babel incident. And he perhaps settled near his very famous great-great-grandson, Peleg, in his final years. We don't know. But it's interesting. It says that Shem, the first thing it says about him is he is the father of all the children of Eber. Well, the word Eber, they think maybe, now they're not sure about this, but they think maybe the word Hebrew came from here because it was his descendants, it was from his descendants that Abraham came. Now, of course, Hebrew literally means to cross over, and Abraham had, of course, crossed over from Ur to this part of the country, and so it could be that the name originated with Abraham, but it could have gone back to this man. He was, in fact, the ancestor of the Hebrews. All right? Let's talk about Shem's sons. Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Well, Elam is the progenitor of the Elamites, which eventually became the Medes, I think, invaded finally. This became Media and Persia here. So they are the progenitors of, and they're Semites, this Persian group. Asher was the founder of the Assyrians. But we don't think of the Assyrians as Semites because they were later, as we're told, invaded by Nimrod. And so as the Assyrians were a mixture of Hamites and Semites. Lud is Lydia. Just a minute here. Lydia. Oh, up here. Okay. They were Semites. And Aram, which for all intents and purposes were the Syrians, not the Assyrians, but the Syrians, just north of Israel, up here, Damascus, they were also Semites. They were the descendants of Aram. And apparently they were a notable group of people because the language they spoke was Aramean. And it became, much like English is now becoming, and Greek was at one time, the lingua franca of the world. It came as near being a world language as anything of its time. You remember that in Jesus' time, they spoke Aramaic. And two books of the Old Testament, Daniel and Ezra, the original manuscripts were in Aramaic. And so these were a very, very important people. They were a great nation. All right? We have four of Aram's children because he was an important person. We have Uz. Well, you recognize that as the homeland of Job, and I'm not prepared to tell you where that was. And then we have four other ones listed. But the most important son of Shem was Arphaxad. We don't know anything about Arphaxad, except he had a son called Selah. And we don't know anything about him, except he had a son called Eber. And now we come to the most intriguing verse in this whole chapter, which is verse 25, which has been debated many, many times. And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, which means division. For in his days was the earth divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Now the question is, what does it mean the earth was divided? Now some people tell you that if you take a map, and I didn't bring a map with the Atlantic Ocean, you can move the western continents, you can move them over and they practically sit on the other side of the Atlantic. And they think this is talking about a continental drift. Well, it might have been talking about that, but I don't think we have to conclude that. Because if you look at 10:5, look here at 10:5. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, and in their nations. So we're talking about Babel. It's just simply saying this man lived. It may be saying what scientists have supposed, although they tell me there are all kinds of problems with that view of this continental drift idea. But anyway, here we have it. It's talking about the division of the lands by languages. So this could simply mean that what happened, we're going to talk about the next time in chapter 11, happened during the time of Peleg. Also look at verse 32. These are the families of the sons of Noah,
after their generations in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. So I tend to think we're talking about this division of nations we've been talking about all morning, rather than an actual continental division of the earth. All right. Peleg was evidently born after the dispersion at Babel. All right, and then in verses 26 to 30, we have the 13 sons of Joktan, about whom we know very little, except they probably settled in the area of Arabia. At least Ophir is a place in Arabia known for its gold. So 10:32 tells us that these were the original nations that came out of the post-flood world. Here we have it. And I told you, and we're going to conclude with this, I told you that this number 70, the Jewish people were great people for symbolism and great people for having all kinds of tokens and symbols of things. And this was very important to them, that there were 70 nations came out of this. Would you turn to Deuteronomy 32, verses 7 and 8? This is a song of Moses. And of course, Moses wrote what we just, or at least he recorded it or passed it on. The original listings may have come from Shem and descendants up down to the time of Moses. But he refers to this. Look at verse 7. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father and he will show thee, thy elders and they will tell thee. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when He separated the sons of Adam, and He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. So Moses is drawing a parallel between these 70 nations and the 70 people that went from Canaan to Egypt. The Bible tells us there were 70 of them. And Moses is saying that's significant. There were 70 nations, and God took 70 people down here, and these are the 70 that He's interested in. If there's one thing that comes out of this that just really blessed me, is how God sees history altogether different from anybody else. We talked about 70 nations scattered all over the world, and Moses is saying that if you want to really know where the important 70 was, it was those 70 people that went from Canaan to Egypt. And they compare with these 70 nations that God divided in the beginning. That just blessed me. Here we are, a little group of people. It'd be interesting to see how God evaluates this little group of people in relationship to everything else that's going on in this community. If we're where God wants us to be, this is extremely significant, what's happening here in this congregation and community. And I guess I'd like to generate a little bit of loyalty to see things the way God sees it in terms of the brotherhood and the importance of what He does with little things like this. There's probably almost nobody in this community knows much about us, and many people don't know we even exist. But Moses says, take those 70 nations, and they compare with this 70 that went down here. And that number 70 became very important in Israel. We have 70 weeks determined upon God's people in the book of Daniel, whatever that means. I'm just giving these. Maybe they don't mean anything. We have Israel led by 70 elders. This is God's kingdom against this other stuff that we've been describing this morning. And we all know who's going to win. I just want to encourage us. 70 members of the Sanhedrin. God's governing body of Israel at one point. 70 scholars translated the Septuagint. Moses wrote Psalm 90, and he says 70 years are determined for the lifespan of an average man. There were 70 years of Babylonian captivity. And Herod's temple was destroyed 70 years after he tried to kill all the infants and kill Christ. That's where I want to conclude. We have this history, especially that awful influence by Nimrod, and it pretty much, his bunch pretty well took over almost the entire earth, except for Indo-Europe and this part of the Middle East. Basically, the rest of the world
was dominated by the spirit of nationalism to the point of violence and subduing people under tyranny. That's what we have to deal with the nations of the world. But God says, my 70 are different than those 70. And we all know, like I said, who's going to win. I would like to conclude this by turning to the book of Daniel. The lesson this morning is, let's look where God looks for significance. And I'm excited. I'm excited what God's going to do about what God's going to do with His 70. And I'm not impressed with what the world thinks they're going to do with their 70. Chapter 2 of Daniel. What did I say? Remember, this was Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and nobody could interpret it. Daniel had to tell both the dream and the interpretation. And so he tells the king what he saw. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This is the kingdom of Nimrod. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass. It was a very attractive, appealing, enticing thing. And most of the world has gotten involved. His legs of iron. There you see the tyranny. There you see what the character of this thing really is. His feet part iron and part clay. Thou sawest till that stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, which were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, the gold, broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. That's pretty insubstantial, isn't it? And the wind carried them away, and no place was found for them. I mean, they completely disappeared. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Verse 44. And in these days, in the days of these kings, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. It's already been set up. Jesus came preaching, the kingdom of God is at hand, which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now, don't you ever read Genesis chapter 10 without reading that passage. That's the true perspective. Does anybody have any comments?